two Sikhs who were in Mrs. Gandhi's personal security bodyguard assassinated her. And since that point, it's tended to have dropped out of Western media what's going on in the Punjab, but it hasn't stopped. And the killing, in fact, last year was probably as bad as it's ever been. In fact, it's been escalating. 86, 87, 88, the numbers have been going up each year. And I thought of including them in this kind of two-week long series I was doing about religion and political conflict in the world, because they provide an interesting example of a religious group that has again resorted to extremist violent means to try to achieve political ends, but the theoretical basis of this is a religion. It's not a ethnic nationalism or linguistic nationalism. This is being done in the name of their religion. There are two other aspects of the Sikh rebellion in the Punjab that are a little bit strange in comparison to some of the movements we've been looking at before, and the kind of conditions that you might come to expect to be the likely ones that would bring forth rebellion. The Sikhs are a minority, it's true, and we've seen threatened minorities very frequently turn to this kind of response, but they are not an oppressed minority. They're not like the Shia in Lebanon, the ones who were at the bottom of the socio-political ladder. In fact, by most standards, the Sikhs within India, although they make up only 2% of the population of India, had disproportionate advantages, or at least had, through their merit, secured positions that would far out of proportion to their numbers. Sikhs were something like 8% of the top administrative, held 8% of the top administrative posts in the central government and bureaucracy. They had income and education levels that were much higher than the rest of the average Indian population. The part of India that they come from is the most prosperous part of India. That's the Punjab here, this region here in the northwest. It has a per capita income that is double the Indian average, and no other state is as high. And so what have they got to complain about is the view of many of the other religious and ethnic and linguistic groups in India. After all, they seem to be doing rather well. Another anomaly about the Sikhs is the fact that whereas many fundamentalist movements, when they go back to the, make a big deal of going back to their roots, if we go back to the roots of Sikhism, what you have is a very quietistic kind of religion, one that is very introspective at its founding, one that would be almost the essence of nonviolence, but which was transformed in the course of its history into a very militant and, in some people would say, in fact, a very martial kind of religion. So we maybe should look at what that transformation was about. The Sikhs, as I said, amounting to about 2% of the population of India, means that there are, well, something close to 11 million Sikhs. Most of them, that is about 80%, are located in the Punjab. Yeah, that's about
those. Those figures just boggle my mind, that 2% is 11 million.
That's about the same number of Lutherans in America, a reference point there. The Sikhs are spread across India, especially in urban areas, but the greatest concentration of them, and this is probably the other factor that makes a rebellion of this kind possible is concentrated in the Punjab area up there in the northwest, which has still about 80% of the total Sikh population up there. The other 20% is scattered in throughout the rest of India. And as some of you know, Sikhs have immigrated not only to the United States and Canada, but if you've done any traveling in Asia or in England, for example, large Sikh community in London, large Sikh communities in Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, in East Africa, large Sikh communities or relatively significant ones who have immigrated at various points during the course of the last century or so. I thought I'd begin by talking a little bit about the origins of Sikhism, because as a religion, it's perhaps not well known as to what its tenets are and what were the conditions of its birth. And then we'll talk a little bit about the current political status there. And I want to try to broaden this a little bit to discuss the Sikh rebellion in the context of the whole Indian situation there. After all, there are other religious groups in India. Is this a unique phenomenon? Are there other kinds of problems on the horizon that would foresee other types of militant religious revivals in India too? The word Sikh means, well, it's derived from a Pali Sanskrit word that means disciple. And the essence of the Sikh religion has been promulgated by a series of gurus, of whom then these followers are disciples. It's a relatively new religion. The founder of Sikhism, a man named Guru Nanak, was born in the 15th century, and he died in 1538. Nanak lived in a time in which there was a great deal of Hindu-Muslim interaction at the popular religious level. One of the key movements in Hinduism at this time was a devotional movement that was known as bhakti, where devotion in the form of simple outpouring of love toward the god in various manifestations, and although the favorite forms that were taken for bhakti movements were forms of the god Vishnu, especially a Krishna. This became the all-embracing avenue of salvation for the poorest of the people. And if one worshipped with all one's heart and devotion God in this way, God, through grace, would grant the equivalent of salvation in the Hindu religious system, which would be released from the continual cycle of death and rebirth. At the same time, on the Muslim side, there were very strong Sufi mystical movements, which were led by saint figures who stressed again a mystical communion with God, which was oftentimes again expressed in very loving kinds of hymns and relationships. And it was quite natural that these two groups would begin to see similarities and to seek each other out, and in many cases to become blurred as followers from one may hook up with a follower from another. And this was the milieu in which Nanak was born at this time. He seems really to be less than of a prophetic kind of founder of a religion, and more of a kind of poet-singer. He was definitely of a mystical bent himself. He allegedly, according to the stories about his childhood, he worked for a Muslim chieftain who had a Muslim named Mardana in his employment, and the two of them began to compose hymns together and set them to music, one doing the words, the other the music, and so you get from the sense that this is a kind of Hindu-Muslim synthesis going on right from the outset. He had what would probably be the equivalent of a wilderness or mystical experience, a Saul on the road to Damascus experience, in which he went into, while he was bathing at the river, he wandered off in some kind of a trance into the forest, reappeared 3 days later, and began to proclaim that there were no differences between Hindus and Muslims, and in various kinds of ecstatic states, began a kind of furious composing of hymns and songs of praise to God. If you look at the hymns of Guru Nanak, he sees God as a transcendent, eminent being, creating man in the world by his by God's will. God has no incarnations, as in Hinduism. The name of God is unimportant, but he favored the title Sat Nam, which means simply true name, to try not to give it any kind of anthropomorphic characteristics. However, God is perceived to be kind and gracious to human beings. That's what's emphasized, not a kind of awesome power of God, not kind of a transcendent God from that perspective. And man's destiny then is found primarily in praise and in service to God. In fact, there's more emphasis in Nanak's teachings on the relationship with God and worshiping God with this love and devotion, really, than on human beings and on their salvation or so and so forth. Nanak was succeeded by one of his disciples who became the second guru, and this started a transmission of 10 gurus, which the Sikhs recognized, and each of them begins to add something to the faith. A couple of important points I'll just summarize here. I won't tell you what each of these were up to. It's not that vital to, for you to know that. But as the order or the followers, the disciples, the Sikhs of these gurus began to multiply in this region of the Punjab, they began to also acquire some kind of territorial base and began to think of more politically as well. The fifth Sikh guru, who lived in the beginning of the 17th century, in fact made a rather bad political decision, which was that he backed one of the sons of the Mughal emperor who was rebelling against his father. The son's rebellion failed, and the Sikh guru was implicated in this rebellion and was executed by the Mughal emperors, who were Muslims. This began a period of enmity then between the Sikhs and the Mughal authorities in Delhi, who were nominally Muslim rulers, although they were incorporating many of the other groups there. And it also began to militarize, in some respects, the Sikhs. This militarization was completed by the 10th Sikh guru, and he's really the other most important one. The first and the last are really the most important, and he is Gobind Rai. And he, just to give you the time frame here, he died in 1708. In the latter stages of the 17th century, the Sikhs were in outright rebellion against the Mughals, and the Mughals were having problems in many other parts of their empire as well, and so they'd become more emboldened. But when they turned to attempt to crush the Sikh rebellion, Gobind Rai's response was to form a special warrior branch within the Sikhs, a group who were known as the Khalsa, pure. The Khalsa the story about the founding of the Khalsa is again, perhaps apocryphal, but tries to embody the spirit with which the Khalsa are to view the world. Allegedly, Gobind Rai had this tent, and he asked for among his followers, are there any of you who are willing to sacrifice your life for your faith and your guru? And one man volunteered. He came in to the tent, and out from the tent came Gobind Rai with a very bloody sword. Is there anyone else who's willing? And again, another man came in, and again he comes out with a bloody sword. Five men came in, and each time he came out with a bloody sword. Then he revealed that he had killed five goats, and the five men came out, and they became the first five heroes to be then initiated into the Khalsa. What did this mean? Well, when you were initiated into the Khalsa, there were rituals of purification that were done with water, etc., that I'll not go into, but it was a kind of rebirth through baptism as well. Like the purification of water in the baptism ritual, there was the taking of a new name. And the name that was taken by members of the Khalsa was, those of you who know Sikhs may recognize this name, Singh. Singh means lion, and all members of the Khalsa then have the name Singh. And Sikhs then that you run into, who wear the turban and the uncut beard and so forth, are Khalsa Sikhs, and they will have Singh in their name someplace. The signs that were to be then taken, or sometimes five, call the five Ks, and off after their equivalent words in Punjabi, are five emblems, again, uncut hair. You carry a comb, which is probably useful if you're going to have uncut hair and beards. The third are short trousers that the Sikhs wore. The fourth is the kirpan, or the saber, the short sword that is carried by the Sikhs. And the fifth is a steel bracelet, which was a kind of amulet from the guru to ward off evil. The soldier saints of the Khalsa also took five vows. The five vows were, here we see a little bit of the puritanical influence, I guess, of Islam, perhaps. No alcohol, no narcotics, no tobacco. And then the other two, devotion to a life of prayer to God, and fifth, a kind of nebulous term, but one which could be invoked in various kinds of spirit, the willingness to battle for righteousness, which could in some ways be interpreted as a call for holy war at times, or simply to be used metaphorically. Gobind Rai, then having formed the Khalsa, then as a heartland, or I should say a core band of warrior saints for Sikhism, died, but said at the time that there would be no more gurus after him. He would be the last of the gurus, and that the Khalsa should then keep the faith pure from this time on. We've had the 10 gurus, now it's time for consolidation, and the Khalsa has the responsibility. In the early 18th century, the Khalsa was driven underground for a while, but in the disintegrating political conditions in India in the late 18th century, the Sikhs arose again in the Punjab and became a powerful state under a remarkable leader whose name was Ranjit Singh. They became masters of all the territory up to Afghanistan and from just a little ways north of Delhi. And that Sikh empire, relatively short-lived as it was, lasted for much of the first half of the 19th century until the British conquered the Sikhs in the 1840s. After the last of the gurus then had died, and this stress on the political and military aspects of Sikhism continued in the 18th and 19th century, the faith itself was consolidated by focusing renewed attention on the Sikh scriptures as the kind of replacement for the gurus. The holy scriptures for the Sikhs are called the Granth. Granth. The Adi Granth, which really means the first volume. And the Granth itself was compiled by the fifth guru, and it essentially contains about 6,000 hymns. About 1,000 of them composed by Nanak and others by other Sikh gurus, and even some are included from some of these Hindu and Muslim saints as well. The Granth is elevated to the sole repository of spiritual authority among the Sikhs, and has become, in fact, the object of worship in the focus of a personification of the Granth in the popular cult. I'll show you some slides of this in a moment. In a Sikh temple, what is installed in the place of honor is a copy of the Granth. And in following some of the rituals associated with Hinduism, the Granth is almost treated as if it were a person. It is awakened in the morning. Reverence is paid to it, offerings are made to it. Sometimes there are special rituals that people perform on special occasions in which the Granth plays a central case. In all processions, the Granth is taken out and carried around. Non-stop readings of the Granth are very popular forms of devotion. Just continually reciting and reading from the Granth. Sikh children are named by opening the Granth and giving someone the name of the first initial at the top of the page. Sikh marriages have the bride and groom walk four times around the Granth while wedding hymns from the Granth are chanted, and so on. The beliefs that are the core beliefs of Sikhism are a kind of mixture from Hinduism and Islam. From the Hindu side, the Sikhs accept the concept of reincarnation and the idea of karma, that the consequences of actions are borne out, if not in this lifetime, inevitably in another, and that their goal then is moksha, or release from this cycle. The Sikhs on the Muslim side, as view God in a much more abstract and absolute way, and are absolute monotheists. They also reject any concept of caste, and one of the practices developed by the early Sikh gurus to ensure that was the custom of communal dining, which is the most clear way, other than marriage, to indicate that caste bars no longer exist. That's one of the things that would be the ultimate taboo. So all Sikhs eat together to wipe those caste distinctions out. Those are perhaps enough in terms of these particular aspects of the faith. Are there any questions at this point? I think what I'll do is show you some slides that indicate a little bit of some of this taken in a Sikh temple. A Sikh temple is called a Gurdwara, and there are numbers of them. As I said, the most important of them is in Amritsar, which is up in the Punjab, and is called the Golden Temple. But I'll show you one that's... this is the tomb of Ranjit Singh, the great, the one most successful Sikh ruler, the one who held an actual empire, and the one now who, by the standards of modern Sikh separatists, is the model who created it. After all, there once was a Sikh empire. There is something in the past that you can look to, and one that wants to be created again. It's in Lahore in Pakistan. Ironically, in fact, because of the partition, about half the Sikh holy places are in Pakistan, and most Sikhs don't have any access to them. This is the throne of Ranjit Singh, which the British took as part of their war booty, and is now sitting in the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, should you care to find it. This is a Sikh Gurdwara. This one is in New Delhi, and it's in a particularly important Gurdwara because it is on the spot where the ninth Sikh guru was executed by the Mughals and where his body was cremated. Oh, sorry. Thank you. That helps a little bit. Yes. All right. Now, on the grounds of the Gurdwara, as I say, you will often, you have kitchens, and then you see this communal meal being eaten here on the grounds by the Sikhs. Inside the Gurdwara, you have underneath the awning and the canopy is where the Granth is installed here. We'll see a little closer here. Devotees coming to pay obeisance. As I say, the behavior, if you watch Sikhs behave in a Gurdwara, is very similar to the kinds of gestures and offerings that are offered in Hindu temples, except it's to the Granth rather than to any image or idol. Here, you can see a couple of things here where people are coming. It's the Granth actually is enshrined right below here where the area is garlanded here. It's right under here in the glass case down here. This is a trough for offerings, and rupee notes and other things can be stuffed down that place. Here again you see there's a person in prostration in front of the Granth.
What are the words across the top?
I don't know exactly what the words are, but I recognize the script is the unique script of the Sikhs called Gurmukhi, which was invented by or devised, put down by one of the Sikh gurus, and I would be quite sure that it's a quotation from the Granth, but I don't know what it is. This is a procession on the occasion of Guru Nanak's birthday. In which the Sikhs are marching through the streets of Delhi. You can see some of the characteristics of the Sikhs. The turbans are over the Sikh men will take their hair and put it into a top knot and then wrap the turban around that way. Also, the beards, which look to be trimmed, are in fact not trimmed. They're rolled up under and then tucked under the chin and usually held with a strap. These are some of the more militant groups, vestiges from the old days, and among other things that were given to the Sikhs as concessions in the Indian Constitution, there are strict gun control laws, for example, and weapons control laws in India. It's another one of those saner countries compared to ours. But the Sikhs, for religious reasons, are allowed to carry their sabers. And can go about armed. These are some of the more rustic Sikhs from the Punjab and also some who are of the more militant type. This was in a political demonstration that I was at in Delhi. There's the slogans in three languages there, Urdu, Hindi, and Punjabi. But you can see that these guys are some tough characters. After the British conquered the Sikh state, they were so impressed with the martial spirit of the Sikhs that they became their favorite recruiting ground for the British army in India. And at the time that the British left, about 20% of the Indian Army was Sikh, even though, as I say, they amounted to only 22% of the whole population. There you can see on the man who's holding the bow and arrow there, you can see on his left hand the iron bracelet there.
Not particularly,
though blue is the favored color of a particular political party that represents one of the more militant groups of Sikhs. This one is one of the lions of the Punjab here. Well, oh. I just had a few that I wanted to give you some visuals on that. Could you reach up and turn that projector off there? Oh, the treasure hunt is on. Yes, the treasure hunt is on.
All the Sikhs in Los Angeles.
Oh, they're seeking ye shall find, right, yeah. Yes. Oh, that's right.
Why don't the Sikhs in India wear white? All the Sikhs in California.
Yeah. There are a couple of sects, and one in California especially has been very much of a proselytizing sect that usually, if you'll see any Westerners who are Sikhs, they're inevitably in the white. But it's not a requirement. It is more of a custom of the particular sect of Sikhs that are the most dominant one out here. It is possible to see Sikhs who aren't wearing white, but you're quite right. Almost all of them do, especially on if they want to represent the kind of Sikh equivalent of fundamentalism, the ones that want to make the statement about their religion. It's sort of like putting on the chador for Muslim women, too. Now, a little bit about the any questions about any of the other stuff here?
These militants, are they defending the tenets of their faith? Is that what they're militant about?
Yeah, the notion was that this was supposed to be a self-defense thing. The forming of the Khalsa itself was to protect the faith, which was in danger. It was being persecuted by Muslims. They were under attack. They could be wiped out. And it had to be then something that was seen to be a last-ditch kind of thing. And theoretically, from the instructions of the guru, that's the way it should be continue to be interpreted, that violence is to be used, you know, only when all other recourse has been tried and when you are in dire straits.
So theoretically, if they have their religious freedom to worship as they wanted, they wouldn't have to have this militant.
This is where it's gotten a little fudged up, along with some of the Islamic fundamentalist movements. It's hard sometimes to sort out the purely religious aspects with the nationalistic aspects. And that's certainly I think a questionable thing as to whether certainly the Sikhs are able to practice their religion such as you saw it there. What some Sikh fundamentalists, if we want to use that label, are proclaiming, however, is that unless they have their own separate political state, conditions will not be there for them to continue to do that. They're afraid of what will happen in the future. And this fear comes from two different ways. One is assimilation into Hinduism. I'm going to argue here in a second that I think that one of the major causes of this is that Hinduism has been so eclectic throughout its history in periodically spinning off reform movements, reactions against some of the key institutions and ideas in Hinduism, but then bringing them back into the fold. If these ideas prove to be long-lasting and popular, Hinduism adopts them as well, and they lose some of their steam and momentum of separateness and then are brought back into the system. They can be brought back into the system socially through the caste system in terms of being kept as a separate group within the Hindu social structure, but considered to be Hindus, and then increasingly also susceptible to various other kinds of Hindu behavior once they accept casteism, for example, again. And this has been a kind of ongoing problem for the Sikhs, particularly after they lost their political kingdom under Ranjit Singh and beginning in the latter part of the 19th century. In the latter part of the 19th century, in fact, it looked as if the Sikhs were going to be reabsorbed back into Hinduism. British, when they started the practice of taking the census, made it a self-reporting census so that people could identify themselves however they felt. And what was noticed in the latter part of the 19th century is that the percentage of Sikhs in the Punjab was going down. People were reporting themselves as Hindus, and even though the population was growing, that was dropping. There were also indications that this absorption process was taking place in the Sikh temples, which, as a result of some complicated maneuvers that I can't go into, had fallen into the hands of Hindu priests as the nominal guardians and people who administered the endowments for the temples. And with these Hindu priests had come the introduction of idols into Sikh temples and Hindu rituals and practices being introduced. There were also in the Punjab a couple of very strong Hindu revival movements in the 19th century, which attempted to purify Sikhs by having them go through certain rituals to bring them back into the fold. And because they were very militantly anti-British, they had some kind of attraction, these revivalist movements did. So that seemed to be doing having its effect as well. In fact, in many families in the Punjab in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the eldest son would often become a Sikh and the other sons Hindus, and it was beginning to be viewed, in fact, as just simply another Hindu sect. Now, the reaction to this set in the 1920s, and some of you who were here yesterday when I was talking about the Muslim separatist movement with Pakistan and how it was connected with the nationalist movement in India led by Gandhi, here's another connection. When the non-cooperation movement began under Gandhi right after World War I, the Sikhs were not initially involved to any major degree. But those of you who saw the Gandhi movie remember perhaps the central horrific image of the movie was what was the Jallianwala Bagh massacre, which took place under General Dyer, in which the people who were having a peaceful meeting were mowed down by the troops. That took place in Amritsar. And if you'll remember from the film, in fact, many of the people were dressed as Sikhs. This was something then that mobilized the local population, which included a lot of Sikhs. And its particular effect was to result in the formation of a Sikh organization known as the Akali Dal. The word Akali means immortal, and that became the primary Sikh political vehicle, which from its outset, its founding then right after this massacre, had two major goals. One was the reinvigoration of Sikhism and Sikh identity through the purification of the temples. But the other was to connect up with the Indian nationalist movement, and again Gandhi, using his flair for building alliances, began to back the Sikhs in what they were doing with their religious reforms and also got their cooperation in the non-cooperation movement against the British. The Akali Party was, again, you might find this kind of ironic given what has happened now, were among the foremost proponents and users of nonviolence in accomplishing their goals. In the 1920s, as a way of reasserting control of these temples, they staged peaceful nonviolent sit-ins in these temples. They were frequently attacked by hired thugs by the temple authorities. They bore up under these beatings without striking back. The papers were full of how bravely they had resisted, and it was very effective in mobilizing a public opinion on their side, and even eventually forcing the British authorities to transfer then the control of these temples then back over to the Sikhs under the Akalis and various other umbrella organizations that they set up. So Sikhism was reinvigorated in the 20s by this combination of a political movement and a reform movement of the religion itself. But partition of India, which was so traumatic for the Hindus and Muslims, was also tremendously traumatic for the Sikhs, because the line that was drawn there between Pakistan and India cut right through the heart of the Punjab, and the Sikhs were on both sides of that line. About half the community was in the side that was going to be in Pakistan, half were in the side that was going to be in India. The Sikhs had done very well for themselves. They were a prosperous community who had benefited from certain favoritism that the British gave them. They were the largest landowners in the central part of the Punjab. And the result was that they had a lot to lose. When they had to abandon Pakistan, they decided, of course, that caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, they eventually chose India, although at the time, something that was pretty well glossed over by everybody, the British, the Indian nationalists, or the Hindu nationalists, and the Muslim nationalists, was the Sikh demand for their own homeland at the time. They thought that they ought to have that. As long as you were partitioning it up for Muslims and Hindus, well, why not give us a homeland? But it was ignored. The result was that, as I say, about half the Sikh community lost everything and became refugees. They fled across the border. Many of them were killed in what can only be called pogroms on both sides of the border that took place. They wound up as refugees on the Indian side, those of them who managed to escape. When partition took place then, and there was an Indian Punjab now and a Pakistani Punjab, the relative percentages of the population in the Punjab were now about, made the Sikhs about 35% of the population and Hindus about 63%. Before that, in pre-partition Punjab, the Sikhs never amounted to more than 14% of the population, because, you know, large percentage of Muslims and large percentage of Hindus. But now with the Muslim part gone and the transfer of population, the Sikhs are up to 35% of the population there in the Punjab. There began to be, within 3 or 4 years after partition, though, increasing signs of tension between the Hindus and Sikhs in the Punjab. Part of this was over linguistic issues. The Hindus wanted to push Hindi as the language, the Sikhs preferring Punjabi, which is a related language. It's sort of like the relationship between French and Spanish. They're same families, but slightly different. And this had led to riots between the two in 1951. Nehru, who was the Prime Minister of India for the first 15 years of its existence, a little more than 15 years, was a out-and-out secularist, a very westernized leader, socialist in his thinking. And he had no sympathy whatsoever for these kinds of divisions within India and wanted to resist them as much as possible. He was forced to concede in a couple of ways of redrawing boundaries to reflect ethnic and linguistic divisions, but he didn't like the precedent being set, and he wanted to resist any calls for a separate kind of boundary that was based on religious lines in this case. So despite the fact that the Akali Dal here continued to agitate for a Sikh majority state within India was their first initial demand. Nehru didn't want to partition, divide up the Punjab in such a way to create such a state. One of the reasons was that he wasn't sure about the loyalty of the Sikhs. They were in a very, put the map back up there, but they were in a very strategic position as far as India was concerned. They were right on the border with Pakistan, with whom there were very hostile feelings, and right between, in fact, the Kashmir, which was a highly disputed area between India and Pakistan, and the rest of northern India. And to create a state or territory that was controlled by the Sikhs, he thought was too great a security risk. But when India, when Nehru died in 64, and then in the following year, Pakistan attacked India and a war was fought in 65, and the Sikhs, you know, were right on the front line. That's the boundary between Amritsar, where the holy city of the Sikhs are, and Lahore, which is a major city in Pakistan, is only about 15 or 16 miles between those two large cities. And the Sikhs then bore the brunt of the invasion. They also were still a large percentage of the Indian army. They fought very bravely. They won the lion's share of military decorations and so forth. They proved their mettle, and it was very difficult after the war then to deny them what they felt they had earned. And so once again, the Punjab was partitioned, and this time made into a much smaller state for the first time with a Sikh majority, where 56% of the population were Sikhs. This should have solved the problem, but it didn't. It didn't because not all Sikhs wanted the same things that the Akali Dal did, which was political control under them to create an image of a Sikh state. A lot of Sikhs were urbanized, had been drawn into the nationalist movement under Gandhi, and voted with the Congress Party. As a result, there was no way in which the major Sikh separatist party, if you want to call the Akalis that, could defeat the Congress at the polls. Even though they had a bare majority in the state, they didn't win all 56% of the Sikh vote. And so they continued to be frustrated in their attempts to get political power in the state. Then in the 60s, late 60s, you get the Green Revolution hitting India. The Green Revolution particularly hit the Punjab, which had ideal conditions for it. It had a very sophisticated canal system that dated back to the beginning of the century, so you had the assured supplies of water. It had a very entrepreneurial peasantry, the Sikh peasantry, and the combination then of the right technology into this very fertile area. The land, Punjab means the land of five rivers. There are the five rivers that join up to form the Indus. Resulted in just an explosion of agricultural productivity and prosperity then coming to those people who lived there. As I said, the income, per capita income in the Punjab became the highest in India and was double the national average. There was great rise in education, but there were some negative impacts for the Sikhs as well. One of them was a demographic trend. As the Sikhs became more prosperous, two things began to happen, or the Punjab became more prosperous. One is that wealth was acquired by enough Sikh families so that Sikh males had the wherewithal to go abroad if they wished. They could buy the plane tickets, they could go get lucrative jobs in Europe, or in Europe, Europe, America, Canada, various places like that. In fact, over the last two decades, 200,000 Sikhs have left India and immigrated and are living overseas over the last two decades. And one of the Sikh leaders said that the most precious export from the Punjab in the 1980s has been Sikh males. They've been exiting for economic opportunities, and it's not that we're talking about rags to riches. We're talking about people who are fairly well off going to be able to make even more money because they have that stake that gets them out of there. The second part of that made for a negative demographic trend was that as the farming operations consolidated, the need and other people left the region, the need for farm labor at harvest time drew people from the poorest sections of India into the Punjab, where by 1981, almost 40% of the people doing field labor were poor people from other Indian states, which means that they were Hindus. So similar to Southern California, where the migrant workers are brought up to work on the fields, the same thing was happening in the Punjab, which was changing, as it does in Southern California, the demographic basis of the state again. So now the Sikhs were down once again from a peak of about 60% down to just hovering over 50% of the population as a result, ironically, of the prosperity that had come to the area. The second thing that came with the increased education, the opportunities for contact outside the state and abroad internationally, the mobility, the modernity that came in, was combined with increased leisure and money, was a noticeable increase in what Sikh elders would call corrupt behavior. Sikhs who learned to drink beer in Germany liked the practice. And after prohibition was abolished in India, liquor was widely available, alcoholism became a problem in the Sikhs, even though, I mean, with just as it is in any other community, not that it was any greater problem, but with a religion that banned any alcohol at all, this was seen as a particularly moral problem and a religious a sign of religious decay and other kinds of modern adaptations that cut across traditional cultural values too. You found young Sikhs finding it quite inconvenient to have uncut hair and beards and began to trim them. Cut their hair. These kinds of things raised alarm bells among conservative Sikhs. They thought, again, these are signs of absorption, not just into Hinduism here, but into a secular tradition, going away from the religion, etc. If we're going to preserve our faith, we need some kind of place where we can set the tenor and the tone. We can establish the moral climate, the rules, you know, and again, this is where it fits with a lot of the more conservative revivalist movements that we've associated with Islam as well. Let's monitor people's behavior, and the only way in which we can do that is when we have our own state to be able to dictate the social, political order. The man who singly, I suppose, is most responsible for launching the rebellion that has now characterized much of the 80s is a man who has been called by Indians as the Sikh Ayatollah Khomeini. He is a man named, I won't put his whole name up here, but his name is Bindranwale. And he was a relatively young man, about in his early 30s in 1980, who came from a rural Sikh village, who had early on in his life joined one of the religious orders of the Sikhs. I should have mentioned in regard to the end of the Guru period that although there are no gurus of the Sikh faith, the importance of a guru is still very strong among Sikhs. That is, you look for a sant or saint, a guru, to provide you with your own moral guidance in this world. And although the Sikh clergy is not a very hierarchical one, and is a kind of self-generated group of holy men, that is, people who adopt the lifestyle rather than go to a seminary, are people who are seen to be these appropriate gurus. They are very important in the lives of any Orthodox Sikh who will defer to the guru's judgment on things. And so this order that Bindranwale joined was one that tended to produce a lot of these Sikh gurus, one of many. It's kind of interesting that the head of his order died in 1977 as a result of an accident in which he got a head injury. Now, the injury in itself was not immediately fatal, but he refused to let doctors cut his hair in order to do the necessary operation on his head, preferring to die in the pure form of the Khalsa with uncut hair. And that was sort of the model, you know, for Bindranwale himself, who then succeeded him as the head of this particular order. Bindranwale, in the late 1970s, began a kind of revivalist campaign in the Sikh villages, going from place to place, preaching the purification of the Sikh religion, not initially any kind of independent Sikh state, but focusing in particular on deviant Sikh sects, those who he perceived had fallen astray from the path. Not, in other words, focusing his animosity on Hindus, but on Sikhs who were straying. Several confrontations between his followers and some of these other groups led to casualties. Publicity increased. And then there began a series of not just intimidations and beating up, but or things. Another thing his group was doing in the late 70s and 80s was attacking tobacconist stores and burning them down, places where liquor was sold, etc. A part of the purification again. But beginning in the early 80s, various opponents of this kind of movement or people who represented more modernist views or deviationist views were getting assassinated. People were being stopped. A man driving on the road was stopped and shot. Well, it could appear to be that he was robbed, but there became more and more of these kinds of incidents, and it became clear that because of the people who were killed, that this was something more than that. Bindranwale and his followers were suspected in some of these incidents, but he was not arrested. Evidence apparently was not forthcoming. When two of his followers, however, were arrested in 1982, he fled to the Golden Temple in Amritsar and claimed sanctuary there, so that feeling that the Indian forces would not violate that. What had happened with Bindranwale and a couple of other groups or leaders who became allied with him was that these young radical extremists had suddenly taken the ball away from the Akali Dal, the old party of Sikh separatism and the political voice they thought of militant Sikhs. And so as not to be left at the dock, these old Sikh politicians began to escalate their demands as well. Unfortunately for the Sikhs and for the Punjab and maybe for India as a whole, this was coming, these demands for more autonomy. We should be a separate, have a separate status than other states. We should have certain territorial concessions. We should have this, we should have this. These came at a bad time, because also concurrently with this rise in Sikh militancy was a rise in Hindu militancy. The Hindu militancy seemed to be a reflection of a backlash against what were perceived to be minority-favoring policies that the Indian government had followed since independence, bending over backward to make sure the Muslims weren't offended and the Jains and the Christians and everybody else and the untouchables. All the minorities seemed to be getting all the breaks, and because the Hindus were the majority, they were being neglected. This was the kind of line that certain revivalists were using. And as it fell on fertile ground, the Congress Party of Indira Gandhi began to fear that their electoral base in the Hindi heartland of North India was going to be undermined if they were perceived to be caving into minorities. And this is then when the Sikhs were beginning to make their demands. Instead, what seemed to be the political politic thing at the time was, let's use a little bit of hard line against this. I mean, these are terrorists who are randomly assassinating good, honest citizens. Law and order is what's required here. This isn't a political solution. The old strategy then that they used to have of ignoring the extremists and giving prominence to Sikhs who were moderate was reversed. Instead, there's a campaign against the extremists. And the result was that you got this Operation Blue Star, as it was called in 1984, in which we talked about at the beginning. The temple was stormed because it was being used, said the Indian authorities, as a base for storing arms and for directing terrorist activities, and it had to be eliminated. The contrary was the response then of the Sikhs was the assassination of Mrs. Gandhi. And what happened after that was a widespread anti-Sikh massacre all throughout India, in which 3,000 were killed and 50,000 lost their homes and businesses in of the Sikh community that lived outside. And this is what has polarized then the entire operation. Many of the moderates who were not sympathetic at all as a result of the experiences that they had after the assassination have become much more sympathetic to, now they feel they're not secure in India any longer. And likewise, Hindus have become much more vociferous against the Sikhs. It's an example of extremists being able to dictate the agenda for both sides here, and it looks bad in terms of the trends. As I said at the beginning, the casualties have been escalating with each year, despite the fact you haven't been hearing about it, and it's still at a stalemate without any reasonable way out. We have dedicated extremists on one side, and they seem to have, simply through random terror and assassination, been able to polarize the situation, and it's